not only recovered from Russia's assault, but it had taken on a new strength. Finally, after I had run out of words, Aman spoke, his eyes still on the soundless spectacle of the falling snow. "You behaved like a fool," he said. His words came low, steady, and heated, with little or no emotion. "You should have destroyed that monster in New York at Trinity Gate when we first had him in our power. The others wanted it. Jesse wanted it. I wanted it. And Gregory and Seth wanted it. Only you didn't want it. Your vanity wouldn't have it." His voice remained calm, his words coming evenly as he went on. "No, your vanity would forgive and cajole and seduce and win the monster over. And so you see what has happened. Marius, Louis, and Gabrielle are gone from us forever. And for what? For your vanity." He stopped, as though he'd exhausted himself. But he didn't look at me. He continued to look at the snow. Benji was deeply distressed, and pleaded with me, with his eyes, to be patient. Gregory did more or less the same thing. "I say nothing in my own defense," I said. "You have nothing to say in your own defense," Armand replied in the same measured voice, "because there is nothing you could say in your own defense. You've never been able to defend any of your great blunders. Making a vampire out of a little child, rousing a queen who had closed her heart and soul to nature and history with the fall of Egypt. But you can listen to me now." He turned and looked up at me, his eyes flashing with malice. "Listen," he said in the same dull monotone. "Listen. Listen when I tell you that you must wipe out, to the very last one, those replimoid creatures whom you're nurturing in the very heart of an unsuspecting world." He paused. I said nothing. He went on. "Wipe them out. Now," he said, "off the face of the earth, which they could so easily destroy. And wipe out the physical body of that hated spirit, Amel, that created us and drove us to turn on one another and nearly took you with him into eternity at Capetria's hands. Do these things. Don't be a fool again. For reasons I don't understand, the elders of this so-called tribe will not do these things unless you give the order. Well, do it. Issue the order that all of those hideous impostors must die. Do it now, for the mortal you once were. Do it now for the mortal world you once loved. Do it now for the mortal destiny you once grieved for. Do it now for the innocent millions out there who have no idea these creatures thrive in their midst, increasing in number with diabolical efficiency. Do it before they have proliferated so that destruction is impossible. Do it for a world that will never know you or thank you, but a world that you can now truly save." Silence. He turned his eyes away from me and back to the snowfall. "Once you wanted recognition from the humans of this planet. Once you were so desperate for their recognition and acclaim that you wrote songs and made films of our very own secret history. You flouted your pledge to Marius, all for the love of your mortal brothers and sisters. Desperate for brief moments of mortal fame and recognition, you urged the human race to wipe us out." Once again he looked at me. "Where is your love for all those mortals now?" he asked. "Where is your great passion to be a mortal hero?" I didn't answer. "You think you've known regret?" he said. You've known nothing like the regret you will feel once those monsters have abandoned you, you and your pitiable blood-drinker acolytes, and run rampant underground. Silence. He sighed as though he had again exhausted himself. He looked at me with eyes full of weariness and disgust, and then again through the window. Behind him, Benji was fighting tears. Gregory appeared to be deep in thought. "I've heard you out," I said to Armand. "I know where you stand. I've known since the beginning that you wanted them annihilated. I cannot do it. I will not." "Fool," he said, eyes flashing on me again. The blood rushed to his cheeks. "I pray with all my heart that the human race discovers those beasts before they grow in such numbers as to be unstoppable. I pray that something natural and wholesome in this universe in which we live rises to engulf them. You won't do anything." "Oh, no," he said. "I will do nothing. How could I do anything? I won't ever rise against you, and you have the strongest and the most lethal members of your court at your disposal. Do you think I want to be given to the mob in your ballroom, torn apart for an evening's entertainment before my remains are tossed into the fire?" "Armand," I said, "please." I dropped down on my knees in front of him, looking up into his face. All the emotion he had held back was printed there now. He was in a rage. "Is your heart totally turned against me?" I asked. "Do you have no faith in what we seek to build here?" "Fool," he said again. His voice was roughened now by emotion he couldn't suppress. "I have always loved you," he said. "I have loved you more than any being in all the world whom I've ever loved. I have loved you more than Louis. I have loved you more even than Marius. And you have never given me your love. I would be your most faithful counselor if you allowed it. But you don't. Your eyes pass over me as if I don't exist. And so they always have." I knelt there defeated. I didn't know where to begin. I didn't know what to say. I felt such a huge exhaustion. I had no way out of it, no way to find eloquence or reason or the vigor to try to reach him, reach beyond his malice, to his soul. He went on again, staring at me as he spoke. "I hate you as much as I have ever loved you," he said. "Oh, I didn't want for Rashomandis to destroy you. Good God, that I never wanted, never. When I heard them crying out that you'd returned, I wept like a child. I never wished for that, for you to vanish into the same darkness that has swallowed Louis and Marius. But how could I not hate you? You who went in search of my maker all those long years ago when I scarce believed in him anymore, and was found by him, saved from the earth by him, welcomed into his lair by him. You whom he loved, you to whom he told the secrets of our beginning, when he had never come to free me from the children of Satan. You to whom he gave his love, while resigning me to the ruins of all you destroyed around me. I hate you. I understand the very definition of hate when I think of you." He broke off, unable to continue. Benji clung tight to him, resting his head on his shoulder, crying softly, and I heard Sibel weeping by the distant fire. I tried in vain to find words, words that would have some meaning, but I couldn't. I had slipped again into knowing and not thinking. I had slipped again into a purposeless awareness that was a blade turning in my heart. "You who humiliated me and destroyed my world," he said. His voice was now a fragile whisper. "You who later told, with such relish, how you shattered my coven, my little coven of holy purpose. Yet still I didn't want for you to die. and I should have known that you wouldn't. Of course not. How could anyone put an end to you? How clumsy Rashomondes must have been in the face of your simple, vulgar cunning. He laughed under his breath. How astonished he must have been to find himself blinded and burning at your hands. You, the upstart Lestat, the brat prince. I found myself on my feet again. I'd drawn back away from him without realizing it. The air was poison between us. But I couldn't look away or go. I love you still, he said. Yes, even now I love you, as they all love you, your minions seeking just a smile or a nod or a quick touch of your hand. I love you like all those throughout this palace who are dreaming of drinking just a drop of your blood. Well, you can leave me now. I'm not going anywhere. Where is there to go? I'll be here if you want me. And grant me my wish for the moment, you and your august friends. Go, and leave me alone. He bent forward and put his face in his hands. Benji came round and moved next to him, forcing Gregory to give way. And Benji held on to him, begging him not to weep, kissing him, and telling him this would change, this would pass, that he and Sibel adored him and could not go on without him, that he must live and love for them. I did not move. He had looked as ever like an angelic boy as he'd said all these things, and there flashed before my memory the first time I had ever laid eyes on him, in the dusty shadows of Notre Dame de Paris, a vagabond angel without wings. I thought of Gabrielle then. I thought of Marius. But no, it was not thinking. It was simply knowing. Knowing what was past, knowing what was present, knowing who and what were gone. I couldn't answer him. I couldn't comfort him. I couldn't say anything. There was no point even to try. It was Gregory who spoke, saying that these were dangerous words from a beloved fellow blood drinker, that it was in dark moments, such as this, that blood drinkers sought to destroy themselves, and that he, Gregory, did not want to leave Armand alone. Armand sat up straight. He took a linen handkerchief from his pocket and blotted his eyes. "Have no fear of that," he said, "for my fear of death is greater than my fear of whatever lies ahead here. I fear that death is like a nightmare from which we can't wake. I fear that, once detached from our bodies, we go on in some confused and anguished state in which we are forever lost and unable to escape. You go and do all those many things that the court demands of you, the busy work of coven building that once so obsessed me and gave me the imitation of a purpose." "Come with us now," said Gregory. He rose and held Armand's left hand in both of his hands. "Not now," said Armand. I wandered away in the direction of the door and found Sant there, waiting for me. "Rest and mourn, then," Gregory said to Armand, "and promise me that if these thoughts become too great for you, you will come to us. You will not seek to harm yourself." Armand gave some confidential answer, but I didn't hear it. I didn't separate the syllables from the crackling noise of the fire or the sounds of Sibel's sobs. Perhaps I realized that I didn't care what Armand was saying. Perhaps I just knew that I didn't. I couldn't be certain. Outside, the wind gusted, driving the snow against the dark panes. I was as broken as I'd been by that wind, or the icy winds of the upper air. I was as bruised and exhausted as if I'd just made the long journey back from Rashomondi's Pacific lair all over again. I walked out of the room and on through the rooms of the chateau, as if I had no feeling in me, no heart to break, greeting the many new lodgers under the roof, listening to this little question or receiving that little compliment as if nothing had happened. And all the rest of the night, I attended to the affairs of the court. And finally, the moment came when I could escape to my bed of marble, and so I did. And the last thing I heard, before I closed my eyes, was Cyril speaking to me in a warm voice, assuring me that all was well with the house, and that I should sleep well knowing it. "In all these centuries," said Cyril, "never have we known one whom we could see as our champion. You can't really know, boss, just what you are now to the others. You think you know, but you don't. And that's why I'll be right outside your door again, sleeping in the passage, sleeping here, so nothing and no one can get at you or hurt you, as long as I live and breathe." Then I was alone in the chilling darkness, with the villain Armand despised, and the son who had not protected his mother, and the lover who had never protected Louis from himself or others, and the miserable pupil of Marius who had so misjudged Rosamondes that now Marius was dead. The edge of sleep can be such a precious time. I felt that quickening again, that prodding from the depths of my soul that some great change was taking place in me, a vital change. And another nagging thought, something to do with language. What was it? Something to do with the language Gregory had been speaking with Santh. Dungeons. They were cleaning out all those dungeons. Rosamondes had said something. And what had I seen? Stairs to a dungeon. Hours later, when the day had died, and the moon and the stars had risen, I knew what it was I'd been struggling to remember. Those last words, coming from Rosamondes as he died. I hurried out of the crypts and went through the house until I came to the council chamber, where the lights were warm and the scent of flowers filled the air. And I found Gregory there, with Seth and Sevrain, the lovely Sevrain, in her gown of white silk, already in discussion about how to carry on Marius's work. Jesse Reeves was there also, a quiet flower in her drab wool clothes. And also Barbara, my dedicated and beloved Barbara, who was scribbling away in a notebook as I came in. Cyril and Thorne had followed me, as expected, and I asked Cyril to find Alessandra and ask her to join us. "And if Everard de Landen is still here, will you find him?"
"You want the fledglings of Rosamondes?" he said.
"Yes, that's what I want." And off he went. I sat down at the table, and realizing they were all looking at me, I began talking. But it was to Gregory that I made my appeal. "Rosamondes said something before he died," I said. "He said something in a foreign tongue, and I don't know what it was." When Alessandra opened the door, she brought David in with her. They were both in black clothes, simple, the clothes of mourning, and I thought I saw ashes in Alessandra's long, smooth hair. I had not had a private moment with David since the night of my return, because he had been busy in England with Capetria and Gremt and others settling the Replimoid colony again. And now we embraced, silently, for the first time since Marius and Louis had been taken. Then he sat down to my left. He looked vaguely clerical in his black suit and simple shirt, and Alessandra might have been a desert wanderer in her black robes. I knew David was feeling the loss of Louis keenly. No one had to tell me this. But I couldn't entertain the awareness, just now, that they were gone. All gone. I had to put that completely out of my mind, as I'd been doing over and over again since I pitched the last of Rosamondes into the flames. I had something to cling to and investigate, and it supported me, rather like Rosh's blood had supported me, with a steel scaffolding, when I thought myself too exhausted to go on. Fact was, I was still exhausted, still bruised all over from the fierce winds and from all that Armand had said to me, and only a remnant of myself was carrying on. But it was carrying on.
"Go on," said Gregory. "What did Rosamondes say?"
In his immaculate hands, he played with an old-fashioned fountain pen and finally laid it down.
"Well, I'm going to try to repeat it," I said. "It was a string of syllables."
Actually, Rush said strange things. I remember him blurting out, "Stop, you don't understand." And I believe he said, "Wait, this is all wrong." And then he said these syllables in a foreign tongue, perhaps ancient Egyptian, and it sounded to me like Beit-ha-so-roar, something like that. I caught an image when he said it of stone steps. I didn't even think of it or register it at the time. I was given over completely to one thing, and that was destroying him, and these words went by me. But it was the last thing, well, almost the last thing he ever said. Gregory was drawing a blank, it seemed, and Santh wasn't in the room. I was about to say something about their ancient tongue when Alessandra spoke up. "Oh, of course," she said, "the old name he used for his private prison. It's from the Hebrew Bible, the name for Pharaoh's prison, where Joseph is kept in the book of Genesis." She then pronounced it precisely as he'd pronounced it, a cluster of syllables I couldn't reproduce, but which I remembered perfectly when I heard her repeat them with such care. She spelled it out for me in our alphabet. Beit-ha-sohar. "That's it," I said. "That's what he said."
"Perhaps he was desperately trying to deceive you," said Gregory, "bargaining that if you'd give up the assault, he'd keep you alive."
He was looking at Seth. Then they spoke to each other in a different language for a few moments, and I caught snatches of similar syllables, but it was all too quick for me. And once again, I saw the stone stairs, and this time, barred cells, and all the usual things one sees in an ancient prison. And the uncomfortable thought came to me that the old dungeon of this house was being cleaned out for a purpose which no one had dared to confess.
"Well, it was the name of his own secret prison," said Alessandra, "the place where he kept mortals in waiting for when he wanted to feast on their blood."
"Yes, and that is very likely what everyone around me is planning for that prison beneath this house. They just don't want to say."
"But, Prince, that old prison is long gone," she said. "The monastery was destroyed centuries ago. All that land is now planted over with vineyards. Machines have plowed those fields. Who knows where those old stones have gone? I saw a garden wall built of old stones in that valley. Old stones that might have come from the very rooms in which I'd once lodged. It's gone, without a trace."
Severin appeared to be pondering. Alessandra was gazing off as if the past had taken hold of her.
"For a while there was a series of archways standing. Ah, but that was long ago, when I was with the children of Satan, and I remember all those white hands pulling at those archways, all those stones falling, and the grass. The grass was like wild wheat."
Her voice trailed off with the last two words.
"What about St. Rain?" I asked. "Could there be a hidden prison on St. Rain?"
"We went to St. Rain," said Seth. "We searched the entire island. There was no dungeon there, only a few easily accessed cells, including the one where he had kept Derek."
David's face was the picture of sadness. "Lestat, why are you putting yourself through this?" he asked. "Kapetri and the others searched the island by day. They went to Budapest and searched the house of his old friend Roland."
"I searched that dwelling as well," said Seth. "There was no real dungeon or prison there, either. Only one miserable windowless chamber, where Derek had been confined, and a couple of other rooms just like it, where, obviously, Roland had kept mortals."
"David, I have to be sure," I said. "Think on it. Why would he cry out like that, saying those words? What if there is some place on St. Rain, away from the castle?"
"Prince, that castle is not a real artifact of the Middle Ages," said Severin. "Rashomandis fashioned it as a blood drinker's refuge, and he had no need of deep dungeons by that time, and there were none there. I, too, searched the entire island. I looked. I listened. I roamed every inch of that place. No dungeons."
"Are you absolutely certain?" I said before I could check myself.
I immediately apologized. I was talking to immortals so much more powerful than I was crestfallen. On the contrary, Seth said, looking directly at me. We're all in awe of you, Prince. We don't feel superior to you. You brought down Rashomandis. We thought it impossible. We still don't quite understand how you did it. I shook my head and put my hands to the sides of my face. I heard Rashomandi's voice, that insistent, "You don't understand." I sat back and found myself staring at the ceiling, at the busy figures so magnificently painted all over it. And then I realized I was looking at the work of Marius, Marius who was gone forever. And suddenly the pain I felt suffocated me and threatened to become more than I could bear. I almost rose to go, but then where would I go? To St. Rain to find nothing? To Budapest, to search a house in which Rosh had likely never lodged? What was it he had said? This is all wrong. What could he have meant? I asked.
Lestat, it's obvious, said Jesse Reeves. He was an egotist, a self-indulgent, lazy immortal, without a particle of depth or true understanding of life. Of course he thought you didn't understand him, because you held him to account for what he'd done to others, and that he couldn't tolerate.
She broke off.
Look, must we go over it again? Well, let me say that if you must go over it, I will excuse myself and leave you to it.
She rose to her feet, and so did I.
Don't leave without my taking you in my arms, I said. I never meant to cause you pain. Truly, I didn't.
You haven't made me angry, she said. She softened all over as I held her. I kissed her thick, copper hair and her forehead.
You're my champion, she whispered. You shed blood for her blood.
But she continued toward the door, and Cyril opened it for her, and she was gone. I couldn't blame her. I settled back into my chair. I want to search any place he might have owned or visited, I said. I feel I must do that. He was trying to tell me something, clearly, about a prison or a dungeon or a hiding place, and I must investigate as fully as I can. Doesn't that make sense to anyone else? Why would he mention a prison?
Very well. We'll do this with you, said Gregory. Tonight, I'll cross the Atlantic and find those vineyards he owned in the Napa Valley. I'll make sure there is no place there that might serve as a prison.
Sant knows the house to which he took you, does he not? Asked Seth.
I'll find him, and we'll go there and search that house.
How stupid of me not to have done that, I whispered. And it was stupid, but then I'd been so exhausted and in such a strange state of disbelief as to what had actually happened.
What do you want me to do? Asked Savrain.
I was touched, suddenly, by their willingness to be pressed into action.
Ah, yes, I said. I'd forgotten about those American vineyards. I ought to go with you, but I can't.
I broke off. The mere thought of riding the icy currents above the clouds exhausted me.
Savrain waited. Gregory waited. David waited.
Alessandra was plainly grieving for Rosh, and lost in her memories, her eyes down. She was singing something to herself, some hymn, and murmuring under her breath.
"And this place in the Loire Valley?" I pressed,
though I hated to interrupt her.
"I was so in love with him then," she said in answer, "when he rescued me and brought me there, and he took me down into the prison. He was talking about Joseph in the Book of Genesis and Pharaoh keeping him in his special prison all those years. He said he was the Pharaoh of his world, and this was the place where he could leave hapless mortals to languish."
I saw it as she described it, the wide stone steps, the damp, glittering on the undressed stone.
There were monks in his prison, monks whom he'd taken prisoner, pleading for their lives, reaching through the bars to entreat him, begging him, if he feared God, to let them go.
I sensed that Savrain and Gregory and the others were seeing it.
He spoke of the Talmud, I think, Alessandra said, staring off. Something about God determining the fate of every individual on the holy feast of Rosh Hashanah. And he said that all blood drinkers should keep a prison. He used that very Hebrew word, such as Pharaoh kept, for human prisoners. But that he, Rosh, was merciful, and let one prisoner go on the first of every year. She laughed suddenly. Until Benedict came. Then he felt passionately mad for Benedict, and Benedict begged him to open the prison and let all those monks go.
But they're mad now, all of them, Rosh protested.
She looked at me. Her face was bright, and she smiled as she went on. He told Benedict they would be received as mad creatures when they raved about their captivity, and they would be put in chains in some place worse than his prison, where he gave them meat and wine every day. She broke off, drifting back into her memories. I didn't dare interrupt her. I wanted desperately for her to go on. Then Benedict won out, she said. She laughed. I see it as if it were yesterday. Benedict rushing down and down and down those curving stairs. And monks coming up, a procession of gaunt and ragged monks in rotting robes, singing, all of them, actually singing some psalm in Latin and running off into the woods. The woods grew right up to the monastery. The woods concealed it from the world. Benedict was jubilant, and after that, Rashomandis was a god in his eyes, as he was to the rest of us. Of course, Rashomandis bolted all the doors, and we kept to the underground rooms ourselves for the next few months, as the priests came looking for the fabled place where the raving monks had been kept in the Beit HaSohar by an Egyptian demon.
But what if that prison remains underground, under all the vines, I asked. Under the forest.
It's possible, she said, but I've searched that land and found nothing. Only several months ago, Sevrain took me there. We found, on a bit of ruin, an old bell tower to an old chapel. The chapel had been a mile from the monastery.
I have to go there, I said. I have to go now. Will you come with me? I have to search for anything that remains of that prison.
I'll go with you, said Sevrain.
In her shimmering white gown with her loose hair, she seemed scarcely prepared for such a journey. But she asked Thorn if he would get her cloak from the library.
The library meant Marius's library, and Thorn was off on the errand immediately.
I will as well, said Alessandra. But Lestat, said David, what do you hope to discover, even if you do find this prison? We've heard not a single solitary word from those he took. They were silenced almost immediately.
I don't want to think about it, I said. I want to go, to see, to find out what he meant when he said those words, why he used those particular words.
He had to mean his old refuge in the Loire.
You do realize that Capetria and Amel visited that land themselves, said David.
They found some modern buildings, said Seth. They went there by day and examined every house to which Rashomandis held title. They were occupied by families who managed his vineyards.
Not all of them, said Sevrain. She was on her feet.
Thorn came in with her long dark cloak and put it over her white shoulders.
There was an empty building.
Yes, said Alessandra. The empty old house with the garden. I remember the garden.
When she climbed to her feet, she took on the gesture and demeanor of an old woman again, the old woman she'd been when I first encountered her, under Les Innocents.
David was at her side. He wore modern clothes, a heavy jacket with a sweater underneath that would keep him warm on the journey, but Alessandra wore only a thin robe.
I was about to say something about it when Thorn appeared again with a long black cashmere coat for her and helped her into it.
Rosh was watching us the whole time we were there, said Sevrain. She turned to me,
and I wanted to take my leave. Finally, he came up and asked us what we were doing there on his land. I told him Alessandra wanted to see the place where she'd been born to darkness, and he said it was all gone, all of it. He asked us to come to St. Rain.
I didn't want to go with him.
Gregory gestured for all of us to wait. He retired to the corner of the room and was talking in a low voice on his iPhone. I could hear Capetria on the other end.
He rang off.
"We'll go there with you," he said to me. "But Kapetria has already searched this unoccupied house from top to bottom. She swears no one has been there in decades."
"Let us go, Lestat," said Seth. "The prison could still be underground. Very likely it is. We won't come back till we've found it. But you stay here. You need your rest. You need to be here in the ballroom. There's a larger crowd there now than last night. Word of the battle with Rashomandes has traveled the world."
"Of course I can't stay behind," I said. "You know I can't."
Chapter 21. It was a house of these times, all right, though not to be called new. I figured it to be at least 300 years old. It was built of the local stone, and had two stories and a high-pitched roof with mullioned windows. And it was indeed empty and silent, and without any connections for heat or light, and almost no furniture. There was no one about. Only the bleak winter vines, stripped of their grapes, running on for miles, and a distant copse of ancient trees of immense size, and the cold rain, a rain worse to me than snow, falling over all as if it were falling on the entire world. A near silent rain that felt like needles on the backs of my hands and on my face. The house was unlocked, and had about it the air of a property abandoned. But as soon as we entered the main room, I spied a fireplace with logs in it and set them alight. There were thick candles on the stone mantel, and I lighted these as well. Dust covered the floor, and spider webs glittered in the corners. I could smell the dust burning in the fireplace. Of course, we did not need this light. We could see very well in the darkness, but the light did make things easier. And I carried a lighted candle with me as I went from room to room. The floor seemed solid everywhere. Every single flag that I tore up was resting on a layer of concrete. Surely this had been part of a modern restoration, but there was no sign that anyone ever came to this place. That is, until I reached the last room, a long, broad chamber, which contained a refectory table with benches on either side. There, suddenly, I came upon an old upright Victrola phonograph on little curved legs, with an old thick black recording disc on the turntable, labeled with the name of a Verdi opera. So perhaps Rashomandes had once come here, long decades ago. Old recordings in brown paper jackets were heaped in the corner. Verdi, Verdi, and more Verdi, and beneath the table I spied what appeared to be a square mosaic, with the figures of Bacchus in a chariot surrounded by worshipping nymphs. "This table's been moved recently," I said. "Look at the marks in the dust." I shoved the table to the side, the legs screeching on the stone, and the bench falling over on its side. The mosaic was beautiful and possibly ancient, dating all the way back to the Roman times. I walked back and forth over it, and tapped it several times with the toe of my boot. I could feel nothing and see nothing that indicated it was not deeply embedded in the stone.
"Except that the stone is all new," said Gregory. "This floor is nothing as old as the mosaic."
At once, David, Alessandra, and Gregory and I were searching the walls everywhere with our hands for some sort of crank or handle, and finding nothing, I became impatient and wanted to search the rest of the house. I walked to the double doors that opened into the garden, and there I saw a great pile of what appeared to be sheets of metal glinting in the light of the rainy sky. Sheets of metal? Now why was that there?
"There could be a thousand reasons," said David, "to patch the roof, to patch the walls."
I went out into the rain and examined the heap, and saw it was all sheets of steel, each sheet maybe 1.5 inches thick.
"What is steel made of?" I asked.
"Iron, mostly iron," said Gregory.
I was even more excited, and David was even more saddened, wishing for all the world that he could somehow save me from all this. Now what was this doing here, all this steel, which is mostly made of iron?
and it hadn't been here very long at all, because green shrubbery was crushed beneath the loose pile of sheets, and deep rutted tire tracks led to the garden, and they were filled with gleaming puddles of rain. It was easy to figure that a heavy vehicle had brought these steel sheets here for some purpose. Gregory stood at my side, oblivious to the cold in his thin, worsted wool business suit and plain shirt and tie. He seemed utterly immune to the rain, slowly drenching his short hair and his face. He looked out over the barren fields, and when he realized that I was shivering, foolishly shivering, he removed his long cashmere scarf and wound it around my neck. I tried to demur, but he wouldn't hear of it. Another figure appeared in the door. It was Santh. He was dressed in a tweed jacket and sweater with a rolled neck, and jeans and boots very much like my own. His blonde hair was groomed for the first time since I'd met him, hanging like a mantle over his shoulders. He too was looking out at the fields, and I realized that he was listening. For a long moment, I watched him intently, as if something wondrous was going to happen. And then it did. "I hear something," he whispered. Gregory glanced at me, and I knew we both were listening, but I heard nothing but the rain on the high roof, and on the gables of the roof, and on the leaves in the distant copse. Such immense trees, surely spared from older forest. "I don't hear anything," Gregory said.
"Neither do I," said Savrain.
"I do," said Santh. "I hear a heartbeat. I think I hear more than one, but I know I hear one."
"Wait a minute," Gregory murmured. His hand tightened on my upper right arm. For a moment he hurt me, but I didn't care.
"It's a heartbeat," said Santh. "It's coming from somewhere under this earth and out there."
"I think I do hear it," said Gregory. "It's irregular, tired."
At once we set to work searching the ground around us, kicking at stones, prying up rocks, digging into the loose earth with the toes of our boots. Then Alessandra gave a cry.
"Ah, there, in the trees, yes, the same trees," she said.
She rushed towards the distant copse and disappeared within the dark trunks and wet leaves. We all came right behind her. Here were ancient stones, turned this way and that by the roots of the trees and relentless vines, which sought to bury them. Santh and Gregory pried the stones loose and tossed them out into the open. Then they both began to dig with their hands until they had cleared the remnant of a floor.
"It's just a piece of flooring," Gregory said, dusting off his knees.
Alessandra hung her head, and Savrain put her arm about Alessandra to comfort her.
"A foolish journey," Alessandra whispered. "I am to blame for it. I never wanted to see this place again, never wanted to be under this sky or these stars."
Santh stood transfixed. Then he turned and fixed his gaze on the distant wooded hill beyond the edge of the vineyard, and he disappeared. Of course he hadn't dematerialized. He had simply used his preternatural speed to reach the nearby forest. Gregory went after him, and so did I. The wet forest was thick and young, and the light of the sky was still plenty for us to see more stones, ancient stones, stones ripped up by more roots, and vines hungry to embrace them. It was a steep ascent, and the mud was wet and slippery, and a cold wind sliced through the forest, clattering in the wet leaves and cutting into my eyes. But I went on searching, as we all did, pitching the stones right and left. Suddenly, Santh appeared, high up the hill. He was beckoning for us to come.
"The old chapel," Alessandra cried.
We were with him in an instant.
"It's close, the heartbeat," Santh said. "And there is definitely more than one heart. But I can hear one heart distinctly. The beat is slow. The being is in a deep sleep, but the being is alive."
There was no mistaking the ruins of the old chapel. We came face to face with a long wall of broken-out arches
ending perpendicular to the square of a broken bell tower. It rose 3 stories into the trees, its walls jagged and broken and gaping at the sky.
"I hear it," Gregory cried. "It's under the ground here."
"I hear it too," said Savrain. "I hear the heartbeat of 2 others as well." I couldn't contain my excitement. Vines covered the whole ruin, thick winter vines, vines thick as ropes, with dark green leaves. And we began to tear at them, stripping them off the stone and ripping them back from the flooring. Suddenly, underneath the veil of vines, I saw the glint of steel. It was a door, plated in steel, a door into the bell tower. A sheet of steel had been cut to size and bolted onto it. I smashed it in, and Santh and Gregory followed me inside. We found ourselves in a rectangular room, open to the sky high above, with a broad stone stairway running down to the right. All of this was new construction. I smelled concrete, and I smelled new wood.
"Rashomandis has repaired all this," said Savrain. "It's been done since we were here."
But I scarcely heard her words, because I had heard something else.
"I hear it," I confessed. "I hear the heart. Only 1 heart, but I hear it."
It was slow, impossibly slow, just as Santh had said, the heart of an ancient one, sleeping. I began to shake all over. David held on to me and led me forward. We hurried down the stairs, with the others following us, and we found ourselves in a large, modern cellar. There lay a stack of sheets of steel, exactly like those beside the house in the old garden. They were new and had their price stickers on them. But all else was thick with dust, and the cellar appeared to have no entrance or exit except for the stairs leading down from above. Frantically, we searched everywhere. Then Santh shoved aside the entire pile of steel sheets, sending them clattering at the far wall. And there was the trap door, the broad trap door with a huge iron ring.
"Wait," said David. He was holding me still, and he stood quiet now until the others were looking at us. "We don't know what we'll find. We don't know what he's done to them."
"Let's go," I said. "Let me open it." Santh stepped in front of me to do the honors. No mortal, indeed no group of mortals, could have pulled open this door. Perhaps I myself could not have pulled it open, but it was nothing to Santh, who opened it and threw it back, revealing its immense thickness. It was like a rectangular cork in the neck of a bottle, the thing, made of stones, bound in iron. The air that rose in our faces was cold and dry, and I smelled blood, not human blood, but our blood, and something else, a strong smell that was familiar and unfamiliar. Santh disappeared into the square of darkness, landing on the floor, far below, with a loud thud.
"Come on down," he called out, his voice echoing off the walls. "It's a short drop."
He was right. The jump was not hard for any of us, but Alessandra was afraid of it, and I took her in my arms and carried her down with me. "This is part of the old house," she cried, as she was placed on her feet.
"Mon Dieu, look at the torches in the corners."
There were 4 of them, and they had been dipped in fresh pitch. It was the pitch that I was smelling. It had been a very long time since I'd held a torch like those in my hand. Santh lighted all of them with the power of his mind, and then took one in hand to illuminate the high arched entrance to a catacomb. "This runs all the way to the old monastery cellars," said Alessandra. "This was a way we could escape if ever the children of darkness surrounded the monastery. We'd come here by this catacomb and go out through the tower." The catacomb was broad and had been swept clean. There were more torches on the walls, and I lighted them as we went along, just wanting the comfort of the illumination, though we could see perfectly by the torch Santh carried in his right hand. For 5 full minutes we walked briskly through this passage, following several sharp turns which appeared to send us back
in the direction from which we had come. I couldn't tell. But finally, we came to a vast room, a room with its own torches to be lighted, and a table against a far wall, and other random items here and there, and sheets of steel glittering in the flickering torchlight. And there, on the barren floor, lay a long row of iron coffins, of the old-time elongated heptagonal shape, the great part of them empty with their lids open, and only three of them closed, and those three being the coffins nearest us. Now David and Alessandra could hear the heartbeat, and I could hear three heartbeats in all. The others looked at me, waiting for me to move first, but I found to my shock that I couldn't do it. I stared at the coffins, prepared for a horror that I could not yet imagine. But Santh stepped up and immediately ripped open the lid from the first one, and we found ourselves staring at what appeared to be an adult body wrapped entirely in a steel shroud. For a moment, I didn't know what to make of it. "He's taken the steel and molded it to the form," said Santh. "He's wrapped it tight, tight as you wrapped Baudouin." "Clever miscreant," said Cyril. "He knew what I'd done to Baudouin. He knew steel is mostly made of iron." Santh peeled back the steel sheathing as though it was nothing, and slowly revealed the body of a woman in a torn white shirt and jeans and boots, her arms and her feet flopping as he lifted her, her head entirely covered by her hair. He set the body down on the stones. I knew it was Gabrielle. I knelt beside her. "Mother," I whispered. I could hear the rhythm of her heart, agonizingly slow. I reached out to part her hair, to uncover her eyes, and then I realized what he'd done to her. It was the back of her head facing me. He had turned her head completely around on her neck. He had broken her neck. I let out a gasp. "Be careful," said Gregory. "No, don't touch her. This is a matter for our vampire doctor. He's broken her spinal cord, and only Fareed will know precisely how to repair it." "If it can be repaired," whispered Sivrain. "Of course it can be repaired," I thought. "Why is she expressing such a doubt? She, one of the eldest. But what if she knows something that I don't know?" Finally, fear took the place of words inside me. "Fareed will know," Gregory said impatiently. And he called to Fareed, begging him to come immediately, describing the strange route and the forest above the vineyards and bell tower. I remained beside Gabrielle, and I kissed the hair on the back of her head, and told her, in a soft voice, that I was here. I took her limp hand in mine, and I kissed it, and I laid my hand gently on her heart, and I told her that I could hear her heart beating. "Let my words find your mind, Mother," I said. "I'm here. I've come. And I'm taking you home. I'm taking all of you home." No sound issued from the body, not even a telepathic sound. But I knew Fareed was on his way, and these next few minutes would be the longest I'd endured in all my life. In a daze, I sat watching as the others removed the remaining two bodies. With immense care, Gregory and Santh folded back the steel wrappings. I recognized Louis's simple dark wool suit and lace-up shoes, and Marius's loose red velvet robe, and they too had suffered the same fate. No sound came from any of them but the beating of their hearts, and that had to mean they were alive and could be restored. It had to mean that. But who knew? What book contained pictures of such disasters and the directions, in bold scientific terms, as to what one was supposed to do with the blood drinker subjected to such indecencies? Would Fareed someday add these horrors to the books he was writing and spell out how such bodies could be reanimated? "I've never seen such a thing done," said Gregory. "But I understand now how he silenced them so quickly. He broke their necks. And
how he managed to bring them here without their being able to utter the smallest cry for us. They are in a death-like sleep. I couldn't bear the sight of them, lying in a row like that, the three of them, their faces turned to the floor. I fell back against the wall. It was as if I'd traveled miles on the wind again, I was so tired. And I began to laugh, almost hysterically, as I gazed at the three of them with their white hands and their clothes just the same as they'd been the night they'd been taken away. I had seen so many horrific things in these last few nights. I knew that my existence was now completely altered. But we had found them. They were here. They were safe. And I was certain, certain, based on all I knew, that the three of them would be fully restored. Rashomandi's words came back to me, his claiming that I didn't understand him at all, his claiming that he was not a monster. But what cruel game had he meant to play? Suddenly, the body of Marius began to move. We were all astonished. One knee rose under the dark red velvet robe, and the heel of his boot scraped the stone floor. Then the body slowly sat upright, and the hands moved sluggishly up to the head. None of us dared to move or to say a word. The hands took their time, feeling the skull through the hair, and then the hands began to turn the head slowly. We heard snapping noises, popping sounds, and even a low grinding, but the face of Marius was now directed toward us, and the eyes, quite suddenly, snapped open and were fired with life. Marius stared at me, and then at the others, and then at me again, and a slow smile appeared on his lips. "I knew you'd come," he said. I rushed forward and helped him to his knees, though of course he did not need it. And as he rose to his feet, I wept in his arms. The only thought in my mind, the only image, the only idea was of Armand, and how Armand would feel when he, too, could hold Marius like this, and know that Marius lived, that Marius had been restored, that all of them were safe and secure. And using my strongest power, I sent the word to him. I sent the news. And I sent my love to Armand with it.
"And the monster?" Marius asked. His voice was hoarse and not quite his own. "What's happened to him?"
"Dead. Destroyed. Gone from the earth," I said.
"You're certain of it?"
"Oh, yes," I said. I laughed. "I'm quite certain of it." I couldn't stop laughing. "I destroyed him with my own hands. I saw his remains burned with my own eyes. He's gone. Vanquished. You can place your trust in me." I gave him to know how it had come about. I lavished upon him the bits and pieces of my memory in a little torrent, and I saw the relief course through him. He closed his eyes. "Lestat," he said, "you are the damnedest creature. May the gods protect you always. You are indeed the damnedest creature." Farid had just arrived. He broke in on our laughing, and I had to get control of myself, or I would pass into crying like a boy. But I was so convinced now that all would be well. I couldn't hold the tears much longer. Farid studied the two bodies, and then asked if Rashomandi's was right-handed. "Yes," I said. He held my axe in his right hand. "Exactly as I thought," said Farid. Then he knelt beside my mother, and taking her head in his hands, he carefully turned it, listening to every tiny snapping or popping noise, as if they were confiding some secret to him. At last, she lay as if in a deep sleep, no breath issuing from her lips, and only her heart beating. "Mother," I called out, "mother, wake up! It's Lestat! It's me!" For a few long, torturous seconds, she lay there, inert, with her eyes half-masked. But then the eyelids fluttered, and she looked up at the ceiling. She took a long, shuddering breath, and her full expression came back to her
as she appeared absorbed in what she saw, her breath rising and falling with one deep breath after another.